Why Russia? Why go to Russia? I visited an uncle. He's about 80 years old now, and he informed me in the genealogical work that he had done while on a mission in Zurich, Switzerland, nearly 50 years ago, that he had learned that one of our great-great-grandmothers spoke Russian, and a great-great-grandfather as well. When my son returned from his mission in 1978, he brought back genealogical sheets. We found that in the 8th century, we had ancestry reaching back into Russia. Do you know where the word Russia comes from? It comes from the Swedish Viking contingent called the Rus, who invaded the Vilma River from Leningrad, present-day Leningrad, to the Vilma River, down along the Volga, and the Dnieper to the Black Sea, and literally conquered all of what is today West Russia in the 8th and 9th century. One of the kings, Barsilov, is one of my ancestors. So in a sense, I was going home to some of my ancestors in Russia. But explorations in a far country helped open up eyes, set aside prejudices, and to be prepared to future visits to countries which are still strange. It was in 1982 that I went to Russia. It was after the spring thaw in Moscow, after a long, hard winter, when the pure white snow had changed to oily yellow and black messes of what might have once been snow, which is heaped up alongside the main road leading out of Moscow. All sorts of conditions of snow. There's aristocratic snow, proletarian bourgeois snow, classless snow, sacred snow, insulted and injured snow, street snow, and backyard snow. Lying on small side roads with little traffic, trodden and driven to ice, while at the same time the great boulevards and prospects are clean and free of snow. The snows of Russia, and of Moscow in particular, the Soviet snow. The long, hard winter may seem a curse to many Russians and many of us from the West, but on two occasions, it is undoubtedly a blessing, 1812 and in 1941. People in Russia have lived through violent times. Their lives have been so crammed with world-shattering events. The fate of the Russian people has been particularly hard. They've been through cruel and bloody wars and more than one revolution. Crippled by World War I, the October Revolution rescued them and put them on their feet. A child of the revolution, a wayward child, but still a child. The great October Revolution transformed Russia into a powerful socialistic state for good or bad. The summer of 1919, when the civil war in the Ukraine was at its fiercest, is still clear. While acacias were in bloom, there had just been a thunderstorm. A band played the International. A bright violet rainbow stood out against the background of a dark bank cloud. When the civil war came to an end, terrible destruction and poverty covered the whole country. The streets of Moscow were blocked by snowdrifts. There was no light in the houses and no food in the shops. Lenin could see the new beginning, however, in the midst of all of this. Lenin saw as early as that a country bright with electric lights, a country of rich harvests and factory chimneys pouring forth smoke. With neither pounds nor dollars, for neither the English nor the Americans would help them at that time, their people began to build. The heroic days of the first five-year plan, the building of Magnitogorsk, the parched desolate steppe, the new railroad lines, the single carriage with a bell on the roof replaced. The sun was hidden by columns of smoke and soot soon, and the wind tore down tents and carried them off into the steppe to be replaced by buildings. It seemed so unlikely that a few years there would be a site of a vast steelwork, the biggest blast furnaces in the world, a coke and chemical combined, socialistic cities, but the Soviet workers could already see in their mind's eye gardens flourishing on the parched steppe and their reflections in wide canals. Untamed nature does not appeal to me, however, and I'm not really frightened by uncharted seas. Dark forests and solitary peaks seem to sadden me at times. Nature is made only beautiful by the presence and activity of human beings. In the building of communism, they completely transform nature, bending her to their needs. Well, there has been the triumphant success of Soviet astronauts, of course, in their historic journeys into space. From splinters of pine to flights by Soviet aircraft, that is the span of our time. Forward, faster than time, that's what's happening. But what energy and what mighty efforts has this victory cost the Soviet people? Moscow, 30th of December 1922, 5 years after the revolution. What a beautiful city it was in that day. The Kremlin hovered in the limpid midst of the driven snow. The chimes of the clock rang out crystal clear from the ancient tower of the Redeemer, hailing the victorious birth of the first socialist federation in the world, and waited great opposition to the restoration. Moscow, in those days, was still by outward appearances an old city. Jackdaws circled around the steep gabled roofs of the bell towers and the golden cupels and cupolas of the churches and chapels. The golden eagle of the Tsar still glittered on the Kremlin towers. Kategorod, the great wall with its rounded gates and lizard green tiles, encircled the old square. But the old aura of aristocrats and merchants was gone. A new soul had been born. A new and different Moscow had grown and flourished. In 63 years, Soviet power had changed the city beyond recognition. It is difficult while walking along the streets to recall what they were like before. One is accustomed to the new Moscow, Gorky Street, the bridges, the metro, Dynamo Stadium, the granite embankments, the electric trains, the asphalt, the metro, the subways, the lights, the skyscrapers. It is sometimes difficult to think that it did not always look like that. When the Bolsheviks made Moscow their capital in March 1918, it was a rundown city of less than 1 million people. Today, over 8 million, and little is left of its provincial character. At the center of the largest country in the world, 2.5 times larger than the United States, but of about the same population, the leading city of the socialistic world and the capital of a superpower, Moscow has had to do a lot of growing and expanding. The Onion Domes. Do you know why the cupolas and the onion domes are that particular architectural character? It represents the flames of Pentecost, the Holy Ghost, the Holy Spirit. They're still the most familiar images of Russia in the West. We must be convinced, however, of the modern character by the fact that well over half the buildings and monuments depicted in most of the books of Moscow and of Russia in general have all been built during the last 50 years. This combination of old and new, the new overshadowing the old and yet including and seeming almost to protect it, captures the essence of Russia today. Moscow was founded 800 years ago and was at first contained within the walls of the old Kremlin. The original wooden walls, which made the Kremlin a fortified city, were soon replaced by stone ones. Moscow itself eventually spilled over into outlying districts. It was a trading center located in the heart of enormous Russian wooded plains. And it grew so much in size and importance that by the mid-16th century it was larger than London. When we flew over to land in Moscow, there had been heavy rains, and all through the birch forests surrounding the city and out across the birch plains, we could see the mud in the roads and the water collecting. There had been excessive rains at that time. And in Moscow, the streets radiated like the spokes of a wheel from the gates of the Kremlin walls. And most of the houses were of wood, with a few brick constructions, and much of the city was destroyed by fire when Napoleon had occupied it in 1812. Today you still have the radiating spokes, but things have been replaced with concrete and steel. Moscow lost most of its political importance when Peter the Great transferred his capital in 1712 to the new town of St. Petersburg. Today you know that as Leningrad. Although with over two-thirds of Muscovites living in new dwellings, Moscow predominantly has a modern appearance. When they built a 2,000 apartment complex, the only thing that I noticed was there was no place to park cars. They're basically a people not permitted really to indulge in the Western extravagance of multiple cars. Foreign visitors are struck by the sheer variety of faces, too, and the costumes and types to be seen milling around on Red Square or visiting the Kremlin on any day of the week is enormous. We spent some time in Red Square, especially to watch the change of the guard. Every type of regional costume from town and from country, from hot and cold lands, could be seen. Moscow has played an important part in welding them together and in creating a feeling of unity in so varied and a vast land. But why go to Moscow? Why go to Russia? Because there's discoveries important in confirming the restoration. Let's give you some background that might help in terms of the historical aspects of the presence of Christianity and of religious activities in Russia. Slavonic, the ancient form of the Slavic speech, is still used ecclesiastically in Russia and other Slavic countries, was one of the earliest languages in Europe to possess a Bible. In the second half of the 9th century, Cyril, Constantine the philosopher, a very educated polyglot, formerly professor at the University of Constantinople, and his brother, went as missionaries from Macedonia to Great Moravia. We have the Cyrillic alphabet developed by him. Here they organized a national church with services in Slavic. For this purpose, they translated portions of the scriptures, writing it in an alphabet which Cyril created for the purpose and now used extensively in Russia. Since at this time there was very little dialectic differentiation of the primitive Slavic languages throughout Central Europe, there was no linguistic obstacles to the spread of the literary language, today called Old Church Slavonic. And among the great majority of the Slavs and through the Moravian mission, this language was the predominant one used. Then, of course, in 1885, the Roman clergy of South Germany forcibly terminated this missionary activity. During the next few centuries, the original version underwent certain modifications reflecting the development of local Slavic dialects. Thus, the Old Church Slavonic manuscripts of the Gospels are extant in several distinct versions, including Bohemian, Bulgarian, Croatian, Macedonian, and Russian, and Slavonian. Now, during subsequent centuries, the Servo-Slavic language developed to such an extent that the Old Church Slavonic version used in the church came to be less and less understood by the common people in the various countries. The first printed edition of the complete Bible in Slavonic was by Prince Ostrog in Russia. This was published by Ostrog in 1581. A revision of the Ostrog Bible, prepared by Arsenios, a Greek, and by several others, was published in Moscow in 1633. Revised during the following century at the behest of the Emperor Peter the Great of 1712. Finally completed and issued in 1751, known as the Bible of Elizabeth, the Hebrew text of the Old Testament reprinted many times, it has remained the standard edition of the Slavonic Bible. Its circulation in Russia, however, because of the illiteracy of the people, was nearly negative. Then a fresh translation of the Gospels began in 1860. The Synod in Russia, a professor of Greek, a man by the name of Lovigian, prepared in installments, published in a church magazine and later printed in one volume in 1875 in today's Leningrad. He included the apocryphal books. They do form part of the Russian Bible. The most recent edition of this particular effort was published in 1956 with the authority of Alexia, the Patriarch of Moscow and all Russia. Under what limitations, you'd be surprised. The Little Russian, or Ruthenian dialect, which is used by people in Ukraine, Galicia, and Bukovina, was employed as a vehicle for the scriptures first in 1869. And then a Ruthenian individual, Kulish, began his translation. His translation was printed in Russian characters in Vienna in 1903. Then in 1921, after the revolution, another version of the New Testament in Ruthenian was published near Lemberg. And this was made by Yaroslav Levitsky and revised by a committee of professors and officials of the Greek Orthodox Church. And that is essentially the history of documents of the Slavonic type. But nevertheless, the Church Slavonic is not intelligible to the Russian people. The Ostrog Bible of 1581, as well as its revisions in 1633 and 1751, is not satisfactory to the laity. So an effort was made to produce a version in the White Russian dialect. It was translated from the Latin Vulgate and used also the Slavonic version, the Bohemian version of 1506. But only portions of this version are extant today. Most of these books were printed in Prague in 1517. Two parts were printed in Vilna a few years later. Editions in the vernacular have never appeared. In St. Petersburg, the Bible Society in 1813, or in old St. Petersburg, now Leningrad, And in 1821, a New Testament in Slavonic and in Great Russian was issued, translated by a committee, appointed again by Tsar Alexander I. In 1820, the year the Restoration began, there was a translation of the Old Testament from Hebrew, and it was begun from the portion from Genesis to Ruth and was finished 5 years later, in 1825. This was printed by the Bible Society in today Leningrad. Apparently, just before it was published, they were compelled, this particular Bible Society, to cease operations under the ban of Tsar Nicholas I. All copies of the scriptures were ordered burned. During the short period of his existence, the Russian Bible Society had opened 290 depots in different parts of the empire. Portions of the Bible were translated and edited in 14 languages, and more than 876,000 copies of the Bible and other parts of it were printed in 26 different languages and dialects. The ascension of Tsar Alexander II in 1856 made it possible for the Holy Synod, under the leadership of Filaret, to resume the work of translating the scriptures. Now, under the general editorship that we'd already mentioned of the professor of Greek Lavinian, then fresh translations began, and we've already brought you up to date. So the current version in Russia of the biblical text is a 1921 version prepared by a committee of professors and officials of the Greek Orthodox Church. Then discoveries began to be made, however, at the end of the last century, because tremendous things have come out of Russia. Let's give you a little account of some of those discoveries and of some of the great Hebrew manuscript collections that are in Russia. In a tape that we prepared on the Cairo Genzia, and in some other research we've done on the Books of Enoch, tapes 107 and 111, we discussed discoveries were made in Cairo, Egypt. There was a man by the name of Abraham Firkovich. On a journey to the east, he came to Cairo. He was a Karaite Jew from the Crimean Peninsula. He is ill-famed on account of the falsification he made of dates on the gravestones of Hebrew manuscripts in order to show that the Karaites, of which he was a member, had settled in the Crimea for a much longer time than was previously accepted and had a greater importance than was usually conceded to them because of the anti-Jewish activities in Russia. He was trying to get some concessions. Firkovich has the credit of bringing together the largest collection of Hebrew manuscripts anywhere in the world. These manuscripts form the two Firkovich collections in the Russian Public Library at Leningrad. This was my first stop, to find out what had happened to those manuscript collections in Leningrad. The first collection was sold to the library by Firkovich himself. The second was acquired by the library in 1876, soon after his death in 1874. Now, we can get an idea of the extent of these collections when we hear that in the second Firkovich collection of manuscripts of the Hebrew Bible and the Masorah, written on parchment alone, there were over 1,582 different manuscripts and 725 written on paper. To appreciate these numbers, remember that in the British Museum, or recall if any of you are familiar, there were only 161 described outside of Russia, and in the British Museum and in the Bodleian Catalog, 146 more of Hebrew biblical manuscripts were known. In both cases, the manuscripts were written on parchment and paper. And the great Kennicott, who tried to use all of the Hebrew manuscripts available in his time in Europe for his great Old Testament in Hebrew, was not able to collate even as many as one-third of these documents, which are today to be found in the one collection in Leningrad alone. Now, the second collection of Firkovich in Leningrad, or is supposed to be in Leningrad, is not only extensive, but is also highly valuable. It was known that the Hebrew biblical manuscripts dated from the 10th and 11th centuries are of extreme rarity. The so-called Babylonian Codex of the Prophets dated from 1916. Now, the King James Version goes back no farther than this date, in manuscripts no older, until others were found after the King James was prepared in 1611. There was also a smaller collection in Leningrad. It had been regarded for a long time as the oldest dated manuscript of the Hebrew Bible. In fact, in 1982, in Netherlands, in Holland, they announced what they call the Leningrad Codex. This is the oldest complete text of the Bible in any place in the world. It's in Leningrad. Now, Aaron ben Moshe ben Asher, some of you are probably familiar with him. He was the greatest Masoretic authority who was finally responsible for the exact punctuation and the exact Masorah of the Tiberian text, which we have in our Bibles. He flourished in the first half of the 10th century AD, about 950. Therefore, there cannot exist books or codices dependent on his authority before that date. The Codex of the Prophets, preserved in the Synagogue of the Karaites in Cairo, written and provided with punctuation in Masorah in 1895 by Ben Asher, was Aaron's father. It is the oldest dated Hebrew manuscript of which we know, until discoveries were made, of course, in the Dead Sea Scrolls and elsewhere. Kale, one of the German specialist manuscripts found in Leningrad in the autumn of 1926, among the manuscripts of the second Firkovich collection, not less than 14 Hebrew manuscripts dated before and between 1929 and 1121, and all of these contained in main the text fixed by this Ben Asher. You're reading a Bible today essentially in the King James Version that was based on this particular text. There can be no doubt that a certain quantity of the manuscripts of the second Firkovich collection came from Cairo. We hear that this Abraham Firkovich did not enter the place himself in Cairo when he got there. He acquired bundles of manuscripts from it. He was a great expert in manuscripts, no doubt about it. He did not gather material at random. He knew how to select important material, and without any doubt, some of the most valuable fragments of the Ginzia discovery in Cairo, where there were 250,000 recovered documents, Firkovich had collected many important ones and removed them. Firkovich had an interest in concealing the way in which he collected his material and the places from which he came. So today, nobody is able to say exactly how far or how many manuscripts of his collection came from Cairo, the Cairo Geniza. In the Leningrad Library, there's a collection of nearly 1,200 fragments which may have come from the Cairo Geniza. Now, these are not part of Firkovich's collection, but a man by the name of Antonin, the Antonin Collection. This collection was brought together by Antonin, a Russian Archimedrandite in Jerusalem. He saw these fragments and brought them to Russia, and they were seen in 1926 by Kale in Leningrad again. He said that this Antonin had a good understanding of such things. He may have got some of his manuscripts also from Cairo. Kale requested several hundreds of these and other fragments to be sent to him so that he could do some studies in the mid-20s. In a most generous way, they did send the documents to him at the Bonn University, where he could study them at his leisure. Then there was also another collection of materials in Leningrad. These came from the Karaite and the area of the Khazars. Now, very little is known about the Karaites and the Khazars, but a fragment of interest was published by Solomon Schechter in 1913. Now, Solomon Schechter was the individual who collected all the documents of real importance in 1896 when he went to the Cairo Geniza. He found an unknown Khazar document. The Khazars formed a mighty kingdom to the north of the Caspian and the Black Sea, with a capital in the lower Volga called Itil. The Arab geographers and historians of the 10th century report many details of their manners and customs, their wars against Arabs, Byzantines, and their other neighbors. In Byzantine Russia, Armenian, and other sources, details about them are reported also. We hear that the king of the Khazars and the upper classes had turned to Judaism and been converted during the caliphate of Harun al-Rashid in the year 686 A.D. The Khazars were defeated by the Russians in the second half of the 10th century, but for several centuries there was a kingdom of the Jews that ruled most of southwest Russia. During the following period, we hear occasionally about their encounters with their neighbors, but nothing more about their Jewish rulers. We do not know when their kingdom finally came to an end, sometime after the 10th or 11th century. For the Jews, the Khazar kingdom is of special interest. It is besides the Jewish kingdom in Adabin, and in the middle of the first century, it was the only Jewish kingdom which came into existence after the beginning of our era. It was the only area where there were Jewish rulers, kings, and priests after the dispersion of the Jews about 70 A.D. under Titus. In about 1577, a certain Isaac Abraham Akrish published in Constantinople a little pamphlet. It provided a great deal of courage and spirit for the Jews, proving that there are known places where Israel possessed kings with strength and power. And here he included correspondence between Joseph, the Jewish king of the Khazars. Among the manuscripts collected by Perkovich, there was an old fragment containing actually a copy of the letter sent by King Joseph to Shishdei. Perkovich had shown the fragment to Schwalzlawn in 1870, when after his death, his collection came to the Russian Public Library in St. Petersburg. The document was rediscovered by Harkavy and published in a German translation. It may be that the fragment belonged to the bundles of documents that Perkovich had acquired from the Cairo Genzia. Now, Solomon Schechter, the Jewish scholar who helped found in 1916 the conservative Jewish movement here in the United States, he found a second Hebrew fragment concerning the Khazars also, written by one of the entourage of the Khazar king. It contains reports of the conversion of the Khazars to Judaism and many historical and geographical details. So there's a great deal of things to be found. Mainly, we're looking for, in Leningrad and elsewhere, documents possessed by this Jewish kingdom in southwest Russia. And what they contain, of course, is of tremendous interest to Latter-day Saints. In any case, it is clear that the Cairo Genzia had produced many fragments and old documents containing a great number of geographical and historical detail. Now, in another area of discovery in Russia, there's a great amount of liturgical poetry composed in the 4th and 5th century. These were preserved in Samaritan liturgies, especially what is called the Defter, a kind of common prayer. This is the oldest part of some of the liturgy and contains a number of interesting poems of the 4th century. Comparatively early, the Jews replaced the Aramaic by Hebrew language in their poetry. The Samaritans, however, retained the Aramaic language. Well, these old fragments and other things and such materials came out of Russia. They were part of the Perkovich collections and are now preserved in the Russian Public Library in Leningrad. This material has so far not been carefully investigated either. Some of that material is of great interest, including some of the poems of another Jewish scholar that are genealogical in character, for they help preserve the genealogical priesthood lines of certain of the lines of Aaron. Then there's the Masorah. Here preserved is a list of differences in the Hebrew consonantal text, very important for translators working in Jewish and Western manuscripts that are available. The Berlin manuscript that had been known earlier always showed the Eastern readings. It was provided with a Masorah, which clearly differed from the Masorah found in the Western manuscripts. There have been discussions of two sources. This is the Babylonian fragments of the Bible, which have been discovered and published by Wirtz. It belonged to the second Perkovich collection in Leningrad and contained four parchment leaves. Babylonian punctuation was not corrected by later Yemenite hands in the Berlin manuscript. Now, Kale, a German student of documents who was searching and knew about some of these things, at his request, got several fragments belonging to the second Perkovich collection sent to him from Leningrad. He was at that time able to do some correlation with the text found, the Yemenite fragment, the Babylonian fragment, and five fragments with the real Babylonian text. These became the broad foundation for a text of the Bible. In fact, he found 60 different manuscripts along this line. He says, "In 1926, I was for 6 weeks in Leningrad, where especially in the Antonin collection of the public library, he found many more fragments of these ancient texts. These were important for revisions of texts that have occurred in the 50s and the 60s of our own time. I had gone to Leningrad to try to find out what had happened to all of these collections. One of the things I found when I arrived at the great hermitage in the public library, which was near there, is that during the World War II, most of those manuscripts had been transferred to a city on the other side of the Ural Mountains. I had some difficulty in trying to locate and get permission to see some of these collections. What I did find is that an international team from Australia, of all places, under Dr. Crown, Alan Crown of the University of Sydney, that they had become specialists in dating and using techniques to date ancient documents. They had gone to Leningrad to study some of these manuscripts, both in the city on the other side of the Urals and in Leningrad itself. The team members, of course, came up with an interesting conclusion. He remarks that many of the earliest manuscripts are in Leningrad. The oldest Hebrew manuscripts in the world are in Leningrad. Now, there are other things of interest. The Karaism, the Karaite movement, they seem to have been based upon documents found along the Dead Sea. They may even have been documents associated with the Dead Sea Scrolls. Someone may have found a cave depository of the Qumran documents, which became the foundation of the Karaite movement. Maybe just a little bit in that vein will help. A man by the name of Anan ben David was the founder of the Karaite movement. He was an authority in rabbinic studies. We hear, for instance, that in 1886, he and his father translated books written in the Aramaic language into Hebrew. As a direct descendant of the royal house of King David, Anan was a candidate for the post of the Jewish exilarch in Babylonia in 761, but he rejected the authority of the Talmud and the Mishnah and exhorted his followers to study the Bible itself. In other words, return to the scriptures, study them specifically. So his succession was opposed. The Karaite movement began. Karaism was sometimes a real danger for the rabbinism. On the other hand, some of the oldest Karaite documents had passed through the hands of Verkhovich and were not left unaltered by him. Their modern editing has not been done with the necessary precautions. The rise of Karaism under Anan ben David, about 760 AD, had a leavening effect on the development of Judaism in the Middle Ages. By its very nature, it was a rebellion against the established form of rabbinism. It allowed a good deal of freedom of thought and investigation. It was an attack on the validity of the oral law. Sectarian movement of Karaism had stimulated the process of clarification of Judaism. And from the heart of controversy, rabbinic Judaism finally emerged, so-called purified and more acceptable to the intelligentsia. The stimulating influence exercised by the Karaites on Judaism in general is well characterized by Mann, and we can take it for granted that the intensified study of the Bible led to a special interest in the text of the Bible. And this eventually led to the Masoretes to develop an acceptable text. And after they had developed it, most of the ancient texts were then destroyed. There's another discovery also that comes from studying materials in Russia. There was a famous copyist in the first half of the 10th century, Shalimo. He wrote a Torah, provided with punctuation in the Masorah. His brother Ephraim finished it in 929. We may suppose that the Aleppo Codex, a quite famous one, was written at nearly the same time. The donation of the codices to the Karaites in Jerusalem apparently came at about that time. We find the grandfather of two princes to whom the codex was given, a man by the name of David Boaz, was a well-known Karaite author. In 993, he wrote a commentary. His son Shlomo was mentioned as a Karaite. Now, a lot of these documents were booty that had been captured by the Crusaders when they took Jerusalem in 15 of July, 1099. All of these manuscripts that were seized were released by King Baldwin a few years later. Many of these eventually showed up in Russia. The Aleppo Codex was in Egypt before it was given to the Karaites. The Linen Codex was copied from another Ben Asher Codex. So we have two very famous codices. One of them, the Leningrad, there's been a great deal of discussion about them. We might conclude that the original of the Leningrad and the Aleppo Codex were two different codices prepared by Aaron Ben Asher. And as we find on the margins of the Aleppo Codex, many more Masoretic notes than in the Leningrad Codex, it is very likely that it was a later development of the text prepared by Aaron Asher. Ben Asher had been occupied with the Aleppo Codex during many years, and he had corrected it many times. It was probably brought out of Egypt sometime around 1100 AD, along with the Aleppo Codex. Now, those are not as interesting, however, as two other very important discoveries. Russia from what we've just discussed, contains many, many important things, not exhausted by the specialists at all. I want to now go to two other great discoveries important to Latter-day Saints in particular. One has to do with the text of the third book of Enoch, discussed in tapes 107 and 111. These texts confirm much Mormon doctrine. And then the discovery in 1863 of the Testament of Abraham, or the Abrahamic Apocalypse of Abraham. Let us just give you a little bit of a summary of the content of some of the material not contained in the previous tapes mentioned. In the Enoch material, in Russia, of all places, is some of the finest, most clear, most explicit confirmation that the Jews knew about the Messiah and all his details. There was an individual in the Enoch text called Metatratron. Let me just give you some information concerning him that'll probably be found in other tapes as well. The enthroned vice-regent of the Holy One. Because of the great love of his master, this individual had authority to be seated on a throne like the throne of glory. Throne of glory generally refers to the great God, the Holy One. This individual was made ruler over celestial and terrestrial worlds. He represents the Godhead to the outside celestial and terrestrial world. In the end of time, this individual will make the throne of glory complete as a throne of judgment. He is over all the angels and through all the celestial regions. All the angels receive their spiritual maintenance, yea, their very existence from him. He is to the angelic world what the heart is to the body. He is over the 12 angels. He is the guardian of the inmost regions of the Shekinah, or the Holy of Holies. He is the guardian of the celestial treasures and the halls. He is especially pointed over the secrets. All the keys are committed to him. He commits the secrets to man. He is the intermediary between the Holy of Holies, the Shekinah, or the throne of glory, which would be God himself, to man. He presents the heavenly academy. From him emanates, in the last instance, all knowledge of the mysteries of the universe. He is the guardian of the spirits and the souls in heaven, both before and after earthly life. He is appointed to give life to those who dwell in the dust, and after death he conducts the spirits and souls back to their places. As I read these, I'm not making any special parallel to any Mormon doctrine. It'll become apparent to those who are familiar with Mormon doctrine exactly what these parallels may be. He introduces the Spirit on high, saying to it, "Enter, enter." He is God's representative and ruler over the world, the celestial judge of the world, the executor of the divine decree, the representative of the Holy One. He is the judge of the world. He unites in himself the attributes of justice and mercy. He is the head of the groups of angels and the angels of justice. He is, of course, the judge of man after death and functions at the last judgment. He was the one who showed himself to Moses and to the prophets. When the Holy One chooses a prophet and destines him to partake of glory, it was this individual who bestowed upon him the prophet, the light of glory. He is the shield of man. Remember that Joseph Smith said that all of the prophets had received from Jesus Christ himself personally their particular authority and priesthood, except Elisha, who received it from Elijah. Now, when the wrath of the Holy One is kindled against his children, he prays for them and transforms them, causes the divine decree to be determined. He is appointed to receive man's prayers. He is appointed over this world, receives the names. He is the eldest servant of his house, the eldest servant. He rules over all the Holy One. He functions at the creation. He has access to the divine presence, who represents the divine presence of man. He is the redeeming angel. He is the first spirit man. He is the eternal spiritual divine essence. He symbolizes the pilgrimage of the spirit from its home in the presence of deity through the different spheres of the universe down to the terrestrial world. He was the beginning of God's creation. He was the prototype of man. He is the first of God's creations. More details might be found in a tape under preparation by Dr. Rennell Erickson that will deal with pre-earth life, tape 130. He is the priest officiating at the celestial altar. He is the divine word. I think you can see in many of these attributes many parallels to Jesus Christ. Then the apocalypse of Adam. Thorough study of this has been done by Dr. Nibley, so therefore I'll just refer to it very briefly. Found in Russia in 1863, first made public, then in German edition in 1897 by Benowitz, then the English version, the very first part of it, appeared in the first volume of the Improvement Era in 1898. Isn't that strange? Here are some of the contents of the Apocalypse of Abraham, considered among the pseudepigrapha, over 100 texts being prepared for publication by 500 men involved. I'll quote to you just from a few of the passages. You can draw your own parallels if you have a book of Abraham. While I thus spake to my father Terah in the court of my house, the voice of the Mighty One from heaven came from a fiery cloud, saying and calling, Get ye out of his house. And as I went out, he was burned, and his house and all that was in it, even to the earth of 40 ells. Abraham, Abraham, thou art seeking in the understanding of thine heart the God of gods and the Creator. I am he. Notice the first chapter of Abraham's second chapter in terms of parallels there. Be not afraid, for I am before the world was a strong God who created even before the light of the world. And in this offering I will show you the eternities and reveal to you that which is secret, and you shall see great things never before beheld. I have called you my friend. I will show you the eternities which have been wrought by my word and firmly established, created, and renewed. Now arise, Abraham, with courage. Go with joy and gladness. I am with you, for the Eternal One has prepared for you honor everlasting. For behold, I am set apart with you and with the generations which have been before prepared out of you, and with me, and the individual speaking is Jehovah, Michael blesses you forevermore. In one of the documents, it states, Abraham builds an altar. He stands around the altar, and Abraham calls upon the Lord, El, 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 Joel, which means, O God, hear the words of my mouth. He's addressing himself to the Creator, who organized the world, who dissolved the confusion of the world, renewing the age of the righteous. Accept my prayer, he says, and be well pleased with it. Likewise also the sacrifice which thou hast prepared thee. Show me who sought thee. Accept me favorably. Show me and teach me and make known to thy servant as thou hast promised me. All of a sudden, Satan appears to Abraham while he is sacrificing and commands his obedience. Abraham, quite perplexed, asks an angel who is nearby, Well, who is this, or what is this, my lord? And the angel tells him, This is godlessness. This is Azazel, who is Satan. Satan has threatened to possess the bodies of Abraham's posterity. The angel rebukes him and says to Satan, For God hath not permitted that the bodies of the righteous should be in thy hand. He then casts Satan out, telling him that God has placed enmity between him and Abraham. Depart from this man, thou canst not lead him astray, because he is an enemy to thee, and of those who follow thee and love what thou willest, the spirits that follow Satan. In another expression, this is of interest, God created a new angelic host every morning, and these cantillate or sing a new song before him, and then they go on, disappear. This ceaseless processing of the world is an ancient teaching. All of this is coming out of Russia. He said to me in the Apocalypse of Abraham, Now look beneath your feet upon the plain and recognize the preformed creature upon the firmament and the beings thereon and the eternities prepared before. Compare that with the third chapter of Abraham. O primeval one, strong one, what is this picture? And he said to me, because Abraham was observing interesting things, This is my will in relation to that which has been in the council, and it became pleasing before me. And in this picture, he had stood before me, and stood before me all who were pre-created, as many as ye have seen. And Abraham goes on and says, And I said, Ruler, strong one, thou who wast before the world, who are the multitude in this picture? Abraham is seeing pre-existence. Created beings. Who are those on the left and who on the right? And he said to me, These for judgment and order, and those for vengeance and destruction at the end of the world. But those on the right side of the picture are the people chosen for me, separated from the peoples of Azazel, Satan, These are those which I have prepared to be born through you, to be called my people. There's another portion, too, that's of interest. This is my will with regard to those who exist in the divine world council, and it seemed well-pleasing before my sight, and then afterward I gave commandment to them through my word. They are the people set apart for me. These are they whom I have ordained to be born of thee and to be called my people. In another portion of this apocalypse of Abraham, whom I before created to be rulers among them, for these proceed men who guide the destinies of all whom you have seen and which has been made known to me. Compare that with 3 Abraham 23, almost virtually identical. Well, there's much more in terms of the Abrahamic material coming out of Russia. In a little recapitulation, out of Russia, we have the largest collection of Hebrew manuscripts anywhere in the world, not yet evaluated, hardly any of them translated, but casting a great deal of importance upon what happened in the 9th and the 10th centuries. Material that's coming out showing that the Jews had documents in southwest Russia containing much of the records of Enoch, material dealing with the spirit world and spirit beings. A couple of the quotes there might help. The spirits that are to be created together with the spirits of the righteous, the highest of the heavens, the souls of the righteous dwell with their king, and already before the creation of the world, and God took counsel before creating them, and the unborn spirits await creation or being given earthly bodies. This idea, in its strictest connotation, says a translator, that the moral character of the spirits is already determined before their embodiment, and the different courses of the living on this earth being merely a consequence of their qualities as developed in their pre-terrestrial existence. It is most exciting to realize that among the Jews, a great deal of our particular teachings of the pre-existence, the spirit world, what happens after death, Abrahamic records, and doctrines are contained in material now being made available out of Russia. Another quotation from one of the records of Enoch, "The spirit was clothed before me," is made to refer to the spirits that have been created, that is to say, clothed with a body. The latter part, "the souls that I have made," is interpreted as referring to the spirits that are formed by God, but yet not created, invested with the body. And those who have been invested with the body then are given a body in the chamber of creative forms designed for the righteous. The body is then here, not the chambers where the spirit dwell until the time appointed for their life on earth, but evidently a chamber where they are conducted at the time when they're about to enter terrestrial bodies. Whoever taught that we're in a terrestrial body at the moment? In this chamber, they are therefore created or invested with a body, a creative form, and the form is determined by the individual in his activities before. When the souls are about to quit their heavenly abode, to leave the preexistence and come down here, says this ancient text, then the soul appears before the Holy One, is blessed, clothed with an exalted pattern, on which are graven the features which it will bear, and then the body is here, rather the chamber containing the preexistent form or types of the bodies. And the abode of the spirits, the unborn spirits, then receive a body. The distinction between righteous and non-righteous is even made in the preexistence. Well, there are many aspects of this. We can treat them in future tapes. You might see tape 130 for additional detail. But the spirits have bodily form and actual bodies. In one of them it says, "And I, Enoch, I saw the spirits of the patriarchs Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the rest of the righteous whom they have brought up out of the graves and who have ascended to heaven." Whoever taught that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob have become gods? Find that in the 132nd section of the Doctrine and Covenants. So there's many parallels that have never been really examined. And in another passage in the book of Enoch, it refers to the fact Enoch sees everything from Adam on down to the end and sees the last generation. And he says, "And I saw in that last generation an individual who was called a Messiah. He was a son of Joseph, and the works and doings that would be done against the nations of that time. This individual was called the Ben Joseph, a sufferer." We've discussed this legend of the Ben Berechiah in previous tapes, 114 and in tape 80. So there's additional confirmation of the Messiah ben Joseph, the ben Berechiah, who would come. A forerunner whose essential characteristic was to be killed. This individual had a certain activity to perform. He was the forerunner of the Messiah ben David. He would be of Ephraim, this Messiah ben Joseph. Well, these are just a slight indication. A journey to Russia, then, is a journey into the past, a journey into a source of materials not yet exhausted. And imagine, of all the places on earth, for confirmation of the restoration, a communist source, communist doctrines containing just tremendous information that we will, in the future, endeavor to try to examine. The most disappointing thing in my trip to Russia, however, was this realization. Circulating now, today, among the youth in Russia is this document. In what sense do we reject morality and ethics? In the sense given to it by the bourgeois who based ethics on God's commandments. On this point, we, of course, say that we do not believe in God and that we know perfectly well that the clergy, the landowners, and the bourgeois invoke the name of God so as to further their own interests to exploiters. Or instead of basing ethics on the commandments of morality, on the commandments of God, they based it on an idealistic or semi-idealistic phrase, which have always amounted to something very similar to God's commandments. We reject any morality based on extra-human or extra-class concepts. We deny God. We do not believe in God. We say this is a deception, dupery, stultification of the peasants and workers in the interests of the landowners and the capitalists. Yet from the very country which makes these statements circulated among their youth, the very confirmation of the restoration in a positive manner is coming forth. It's a very positive declaration, but it is a very serious one. Okay, then what do they base their morality on? We say that our morality is entirely subordinated to the interests of the proletariat class struggle. Our morality stems from the interests of the class struggle of the proletariat. That's about no morality at all. And that's what it amounts to. In Russia, they're gravely concerned about the fetters of their freedoms, the concern about the lack of interest in children, the disorganization of families. And yet, circulating in their greatest libraries in Moscow, they showed me the Lenin Library, 27 million volumes. And yet, those volumes of the greatest and most important interest are denied access. The public cannot get them unless they have special permission. The Leningrad Library, I had to literally sneak at great cost away from the tourist group to be able to verify the presence of those great collections. They have been permitted access by just a few specialists that we've mentioned, but at this time, 1983, less than 1% of the ancient documents held by the Russians in their libraries that had been prepared, assembled, maintained, and understood and known by Jews from the first to the at least 11th century in Russia will be some of the finest and are proving to be the greatest confirmations of Mormon doctrine and Mormon restored literature in all the world. Ancestry in Russia, indeed. Confirmation of the restoration, most exciting. Someday I hope to go back and do more work, and others undoubtedly are trying to. With the new publications of the team that dated the manuscripts, they most certainly have verified everything. When that particular team, Dr. Crown's group, have published all of their evaluations of the Hebrew manuscripts, undoubtedly there will be an effort on the part of specialists to return to Russia to gain access to them. What will they reveal? No more than they already have. The restoration of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is confirmed here and in many other discoveries worldwide. My testimony of the gospel was greatly enriched, but I was saddened that 280 million people of the Lord's children on the face of the earth are denied a knowledge of what we have. But we're informed by the prophecies of the prophet Joseph Smith, we will eventually glean Ephraim out of Russia. And when we do, then the Russians will know they've had the truth for nearly 2,000 years. In Christ's name, amen.